Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin.
What does it mean to teach the faith? Our focus in this lecture is not on the nature of faith, which we have already seen, but on teaching it to others, so as to sharpen this focus more clearly, a few preliminary remarks might be in order. No one can give what he does not have. This is as true in the spirit as in the body. Unless a person is himself a convinced believer, he can, no doubt about it, he can teach about the faith, but he cannot effectively teach the faith. Moreover, when we use a word like teach or teacher relative to religion, we are obviously talking in analogous terms. No two subjects, say literature and mathematics, are taught in the same way. Or if they are taught in the same way, one at least will not be learned. This is all the more true when we speak about teaching religion. Since religion involves the whole personality and involves a total immersion of a human being, it cannot be taught as just another academic discipline, or at least it should not be taught that way. Its function is to evoke a response and not merely to inform, and to make demands of a person's commitment, not merely to satisfy his curiosity or develop some practical skill. Having said this, we now inquire what it does mean to teach the faith. For the sake of conciseness, let me isolate what I consider the main features characteristic of teaching the faith. First, to teach the faith means to make the faith understandable, as far as that is possible, to the human mind. Second, to teach the faith means to help make the faith vitally effective in the practice of what Christians who believe are supposed to do in the following of Christ. And thirdly, to teach the faith means to motivate the believer to want to communicate to others what he already, though undeservingly, has received. Making the faith understandable. Any approach to talking about making the faith understandable presupposes what needs to be strongly emphasized: that faith is essentially an assent of the mind to what God has revealed about Himself and His expectations of mankind. The Christian faith may and should affect the whole man, will and feelings, and even his bodily faculties. And the whole idea of piety as distinct from faith and growing out of faith is a relevant subject to discuss when some people are embarrassed with Catholic devotions like the Rosary or Benediction. But faith as faith in its inner essence is not a mere feeling. It is not even just devotion. And least of all is it some form of religious sentimentality. Faith is a virtue, and a virtue of the mind. A mind which God enlightens to accept on His word what the naked intellect, by its own powers, could not so much as conceive, let alone be ready to subscribe to, on the authority of the revealing God. Having said this, we should not be surprised that faith, though never fully comprehensible, is and ought to become increasingly understandable. By understandable, I mean it is one thing to say, I believe in Jesus Christ. It is something more and better to also be able to explain to myself, which is what understanding anything is all about. Explain to myself, in what intelligible sense do I affirm that the man, like me, born of a woman, Jesus of Nazareth, was and is the infinite Son of God? As a clue to a larger subject than we can tackle now, one word here on this subject of making the faith understandable as the first role of a teacher in teaching the faith. One word is precious. It is a key to this whole matter of understanding what we believe and consequently teaching others to understand also. The key word is analogy. It is so important that I think it deserves more than passing attention, even in what must necessarily be a short lecture. On this basic matter, the Church herself has given us, in the solemn teaching of the First Vatican Council, the pedagogical principles by which the mysteries of faith can be understood with increased lucidity, always, of course, by the aid of divine grace. In treating of the relationship between faith and reason, the Vatican Council declared that although divine mysteries can never be comprehended by reason alone, that's why they are mysteries, Nevertheless, when enlightened by grace, I quote the counsel, reason attains some, and that a very fruitful understanding of mysteries from the analogy of those things which it naturally knows, unquote, First Vatican. Consequently, by means of analogies, that is, by means of comparisons, of similarities with known things in nature, we can penetrate ever more deeply into the mysteries of the Christian faith. Or as I tell my divinity school students, the only intelligibility that the mysteries of faith can have is by comparison with the known things from nature. The basis of these comparisons, in order to be valid, and therefore for a Catholic teacher pedagogically sound, must accord with sacred scripture and valid tradition, and the process of comparing should be guided by the Church's teaching, telling us how far the correlation or illustration, which is the weakest word we can use for a majestic subject. But within these limits, the method of analogy is not only useful, but indispensable for teaching the truths of revelation. Years ago, when I began teaching theology, I asked the veteran from the battlefield, "How do you teach theology?" I have never forgotten his very homely advice. The best thing you can teach future priests is to make sound comparisons, to have apt illustrations for the mysteries of the faith. The parables of the gospel are the prime applications of this principle. The kingdom of heaven is likened to a marriage feast. The church is compared to a grain of mustard seed. The mercy of God is similar to the love of a father for his prodigal son. Sanctifying grace is described as a wedding garment, and the just man is like to a house that is built upon the rock. Suppose we illustrate the principle theologically by looking at the mystery of the Incarnation. The fundamental analogy, that is, comparison, which Christian tradition uses for the Incarnation is the union of body and soul in man. Arguing against the rationalists of his day, St. Augustine made this complaint. Let's listen. He is the church's first great teacher of religion. There are some who insist on an explanation of how the Godhead was so commingled with man's nature as to constitute the one person of Christ. Since this had to be done once, as if they themselves could explain how the soul is so united to the body as to constitute the one person of a man, an event which occurs every day. For just as the soul is united to the body in one person, so as to constitute man, so God is united to man in one person, so as to constitute Christ. Unquote. Augustine. Augustine's point was that it is unreasonable to refuse to believe that God and man are united in Jesus Christ when we do not fully understand how body and soul are united in ourselves. Obviously, we do know a great deal about the latter union in ourselves because it is natural. And this can help to understand the former, which is supernatural. Also, we read in the Athanasian Creed, which is part of the divine office, quote, "As the rational soul and the flesh is one man, so God and man is one Christ." That's the Athanasian Creed. Given this similitude, the teacher is ready to use it as a key to explain the various aspects of the Incarnation, which form an essential part of Christian education. Literally, every phase of the hypostatic union, which is a profound mystery, can be clarified in myriad ways by applying analogously to the union of the two natures in Christ what we know from reason and philosophy about the union of body and spirit in a human being. So far, the subject of making the faith understandable, especially by the use of comparisons, similitudes, illustrations, in a word, analogies, as, by the way, the first great teacher taught the people of his day. Making the faith vitally effective. Our second dimension to examining the teaching of faith is to see how it can be made vitally effective in the lives of those whom we teach. How do we understand making the faith vitally effective? I take this as so motivating the will of the learner as to inspire him with a desire to carry into effect in his individual and social life what the precepts and counsels of the gospel purportedly say is true. Let me insert a parenthesis. On this level of how to teach the faith, you will notice the concern is not with enlightening the mind. That's making the faith understandable. But rather with moving the will. And if there has been one serious error in past Catholic education, it has been an overstress on cultivating the mind without being sufficiently aware of moving the will. Why is that important? I am still on my parenthesis. It is important for two reasons. One, because in the last analysis, all moral life is in the will. We are good or bad, depending on our wills, to a degree that we define a human act as moral when it is a free act directed by a free human will. So that every training of the will is ipso facto a training in the fundamental faculty of the moral order. But secondly, psychology tells us that the will is the sovereign faculty of a human being. If I want to, I can lift my hand. If I want to, I can lower it. If I want to, I can open my eyes and read. If I want to, I can close my eyes and not read. If I want to, I can start thinking. If I want to, I can stop thinking. There is no power of the human spirit which is not under the aegis of man's free will. Hence the radical importance of stressing the training of the will, both because it is of the essence of morality and because it is the master faculty of human nature. Close parentheses. We said it is important, very important, that the will be motivated in Catholic education. The question is, how should this be done? I may capsulize what I want to say by making three affirmations, each beginning with the word primary. The primary object of Catholic religious education is the person of Jesus Christ. The primary purpose of Catholic religious education is to inspire others to an ever greater and greater love for Christ. The primary means for achieving this purpose is for the parent or teacher to himself or herself be deeply in love with Christ. I say that the primary object of Catholic religious education is the person of Jesus Christ. It may sound like one, but this is no platitude. There seem to be so many objects to teaching religion. There are doctrines and precepts. There are practices and ritual. There are laws and recommendations. There are prominent people who form the sayings of Christian biography and important events which have shaped Catholic ecclesiastical history. Yet, notwithstanding, the main object on which the parent or teacher should concentrate is the person of God in human flesh. His life and actions, his principles and conduct, are either the primordial focus of religious education, or that education is not Christian and certainly not Catholic.
This conference is continued on Side B.